hysterical and cried. So we all yelled out, forgive us. G'day fellow Israelites and welcome to episode 3 of Christian Identity Australia. This episode was posted on the ChristianIdentityForum.net, which is ground zero for all CIL's podcasts, late August 2014. I'm Obadiah 118, or Obi if you prefer, and I am your host. Now, I just greeted fellow Israelites. By Israelites, I don't mean Jews. Jews are not Israelites, and Israelites are most definitely not Jews. Being a Christian identist, I'm a white nationalist by default, since Christian identity teaches, because the Bible does, that the white race, of which the Israelites are a subgroup, must live in lands of their own, separate from all other races. But many white nationalists, though they correctly believe that the Jewish Holocaust is pure bunkum, also believe that the Jews are the Israelites of the Old Testament. And you hear some of these white nationalists on the various pro-white podcasts decrying what a bloodthirsty lot the Israelites and Yahweh were, yet these selfsame people praise the Vikings and the Romans, who were no less sanguinary and were Israelites themselves. What staggering irony. In Ezekiel chapter 38, the Bible prophesies that a confederation of enemy military forces will in some future time attack Israel, who will dwell in the land of unwalled villages. Now, does modern-day Israel look like an unwalled village to you? I mean, there are mammoth 30-foot-high reinforced concrete walls with barbed wire and armed guards all around the place. Just do a Google image search of walls around Israel and have a look for yourself. So this raises an important question. Why is Israel a walled village when the Bible says it's an unwalled village? Because it's not Israel. Because the people passing themselves off as Jews today are not Israelites. They are what Revelation chapter 2 verse 9 calls the synagogue of Satan. Jews who say they are Jews but are not Jews. They are imposters. They have stolen the identity of the true Israelites, who are to be found in the white European race, the people we know today as Anglo-Saxons, Celts, Scandinavians, Germans, etc. Now, since Jews, Judeo-Christians who aren't Christians at all, and Jewish publishing houses that push unscriptural garbage like Hal Lindsey's The Late Great Planet Earth onto the unsuspecting white public, since all of them want us to believe that the Jews are God's chosen people and that the Jews are the people of the Old Testament, that ought to tell any white nationalist with an ounce of common sense that the Jews are not God's people, never have been and never will be. If we're going to believe that the Jews are the chosen race simply because Jews say so, then we must also believe that the Holocaust actually happened because the Jews also say so. Stop buying and spreading Jew lies, white nationalists. If there's a bigger lie than the Holocaust, it's that the Jews are Israel.
And then Cain, he laid down with the mud people. And out of these fornications came the Edomites. They're the Jews, right?
Okay, in this episode we're going to look at the surprising, possibly true origin of the Australian Aborigine, at some Australian Jew movers and shakers who prove that Jews are the same the whole world over. We're going to solve a controversy within Christian identity, or at least give it our best shot. We're going to see why the racially mixed almost always side with the non-white part of their DNA. Why is it so? And we're going to look at the story of the prince and the pauper as it's never been looked at before. On top of all that, your ears are going to be blessed with an epic cover version, one of the all-time greatest, as a matter of fact, in our classic Oz Rock segment, so stick around, white folk, there's fun to be had.
In the bad backlands of Australia, many years ago, the Aborigine tribes were meeting, having a big powwow.
We got a lot of trouble, Chief, on account of your son, Mac.
My boy, Mac? Why? What's wrong with him?
Our boomerang won't come back.
Your boomerang won't come back.
My boomerang won't come back. My boomerang won't come back. I've waved the thing all over the place. Practiced till I was black in the face. I'm a big disgrace, the aborigine race. My boomerang won't come back. I can ride a kangaroo.
Yeah, yeah.
Make kinkajou stew.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm a big disgrace, the aborigine race. My boomerang won't come back.
The Vatican Pride.
I came across this fascinating article on the origin of the Australian Aborigine in the Volume 15, Number 28 edition of the On Target newsletter. That's a weekly newsletter published by the Australian League of Rights, which is a long-standing white nationalist organisation here. You can download the article from their website, which you'll find in the On Target archives section at alor.org. That's A-L-O-R, as in Australian League of Rights, .org. Betty Lux writes, I remember the Lindy Chamberlain case. Lindy was charged with murdering her baby Azaria whilst holidaying with her family at the public campground at Ayers Rock. I went to a public meeting in the Adelaide Town Hall organised by folk concerned that Lindy received justice. One of the speakers was a dingo expert who referred to the fact that the dingo was not native to Australia and was a cousin to the Indian wolf or dog. Author Rodney Liddell, in his book Cape York, the Savage Frontier, filled in many gaps for me of the link between the Indian wolf dog and the Australian dingo and modern Australian Aboriginals. It's a fascinating story, and whilst Liddell focuses more on the early history between the Aboriginals and early settlers, it's his references to the pre-Dravidian background of the Aboriginals that took my attention. Liddell writes, quote, whilst researching the history of Cape York, I found it necessary to retrace the origins of man on the Australian continent. It soon became apparent that the original Australians were definitely not the people we now refer to as Aboriginals. For over 200 years, Australians have been constantly indoctrinated into accepting the dark-skinned natives that Captain Cook saw in 1770 as being the original Australians. Yet truth is stranger than fiction, for all the latest anthropological evidence shows very clearly that the original Australians were Papuans, who came down from New Guinea when both countries were connected by a natural land bridge estimated to have been 100 miles wide, consisting of vast lowlands and undulating hills. The final separation was caused by rising seas which flooded the lowlands, leaving only the highest parts above water, thereby creating 200 islands within a shallow sea, now known as the Torres Strait. The breaching of this land bridge is generally believed to have occurred around 7,000 years ago. Prior to the separation, the Papuans had access all over the continent, including Tasmania. It is a point of fact that the Tasmanians were positively identified last century as being of a Papuan race. In 1930, a book titled Artists in Strings was published. The author was Kathleen Haddon. She was the daughter of one of the world's most highly acclaimed anthropologists in his day, Alfred Court Haddon. She'd travelled the world with her famous father, and in reference to the Australian Aborigines, she stated, quote, long-headed, broad-nosed people of pre-Dravidian stock are connected racially with the Veda and certain jungle tribes of South India, rather than the neighbouring Papuans and Melanesians. These pre-Dravidians appear to have displaced an earlier woolly-haired people who had come into Australia via New Guinea and who survived until recent times only in Tasmania, unquote. This statement is but a portion of a mass of evidence which proves that the original Australians were Papuans, who were brutally massacred by the pre-Dravidian invaders, whom we now erroneously refer to as the Aborigines of Australia, but who in fact were the Aborigines of South India and Ceylon. Unquote. Lux continues. In April 1898, Professor Haddon led the Cambridge Anthropological Expedition to the Torres Strait and later carried out further research in Australia. He clearly identified the Australian Aborigine as being of the same pre-Dravidian race. In 1909, Haddon published The Races of Man and exposed the invasion of Australia by the Aborigines, pre-Dravidians. He states, quote, Australia was originally inhabited by Papuans or Negritos, who wandered on foot to the extreme south of that continent. When Bass Strait was formed, those who were cut off from the mainland formed the ancestors of the Tasmanians. Later, a pre-Dravidian race migrated into Australia and overran the continent and absorbed the sparse Aboriginal population, the latter being driven off or exterminated or even partially assimilated. But the formation of Bass Strait prevented the entry of the Australians, or pre-Dravidians, into Tasmania. Unquote. Further evidence that the Aborigines invaded Australia comes from Professor A.P. Elkin, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology, Sydney University, during the 1950s. Professor Elkin was said to be the leading authority in his day on this vital subject. He also claimed that the Aborigines were the early Aborigines of South India and classified all the pre-Dravidians as Australoids. In his book, The Australian Aborigines, he states, quote, "Was there a preceding race in Australia, namely the Tasmanians? The latter were a negroid group related to the Melanesians and Papuans. If the Tasmanians were living in parts of Australia at the time the Aborigines commenced their invasion, they must have been either conquered and absorbed or extinguished. It is also possible that the Tasmanians were already in their island home as well as on the mainland at the time of the Australoid invasion." Unquote. Still further evidence comes from E.R. Gribble, who wrote A Despised Race. He states, quote, "The first inhabitants were a negroid race, being curly-haired. Later came the Dravidians, pre-Dravidians, a straight-haired race driven from Egypt through the north of India. In both these places, indications of the use of the boomerang have been found. In Tutankhamun's tomb, there were two model boomerangs wrought in silver. These pre-Dravidians were huntsmen and brought the dog with them. They conquered the negroids and intermarried. These two types of hair were found as far as the southern portions of Australia, showing the intermixture of the two races. On the other hand, in Tasmania, only the curly-haired were found, and no dingoes. Another difference was the status of the women in a tribe. In Tasmania, they were well-treated, but on the mainland, they were regarded merely as goods and chattels, i.e. slaves." Unquote. All right, now I think this is Lux writing here, although I'm not quite sure, seeing that this article tends to have quotes within quotes within quotes, so it gets a little bit confusing. But anyway, I think it's Lux who writes, "When the invaders left India in their canoes and rafts, small groups dropped off along the way and settled in Malaya and the Celebes, where they are known as the Sakai and Tuala. The main groups are believed to have landed on Cape York Peninsula and other areas of northern Australia." Professor Elkin states, quote, "We may picture them reaching Australia finally by raft or canoe, bringing with them the dog, dingo, which is not indigenous and had to rely on man for its transport to its new home. The Aborigines landed in northern Australia, probably on Cape York Peninsula." Unquote. Now, you may be wondering why I've brought this subject up at this point in time. I think it has relevance when considering the recent news of a couple of boatloads of asylum seekers attempting to reach these shores sailing from India. I'm not sure that the boat in which the asylum seekers sailed is any more seaworthy than the Egyptian ship of 1250 BC. But the point is that if these people can sail from India in 2014, couldn't their pre-Dravidian ancestors have done so earlier, bringing their wolf dogs with them? Unquote. So the Oz Abbo turns out to be Indian in origin, and so does the dingo. If history and anthropology is full of anything, it surprises.
Judeo-Christians everywhere, they think they really care. Just myself, I can't conceive all the things they believe. My one and only prayer is that someday I'll share my hopes, my dreams come true, the truth about the Jews. None of us can ever know how much they hate it so. My only prayer will be someday they all will see, but it's all only make-believe. My heart's a wedding ring, Jesus is all my everything. He sets my heart on fire to find out who's alive. Some of us already know how far we have to go. My only prayer will be someday they all will see, but it's all only one and only friend. Is that someday I'll share my hope, my dreams come true. The truth about the Jew. None of us can never know how much they hate us so.
I was listening to an interview that Mike Harris, who hosted a radio show called Short End of the Stick, conducted with Frosty Wooldridge some months ago. Wooldridge is an American commentator who advocates against further non-white immigration to the US, primarily because that country will collapse under the sheer weight of numbers. At one point, Harris told Wooldridge that the Jews were behind the coloured flood, but Wooldridge was reluctant to believe it because, as he argued, Muslims comprise a large percentage of the immigration numbers, and everybody knows that Muslims hate Jews. Why, Wooldridge asked, would Jews want to bring Muslims into a country in such numbers that it would eventually pose a serious threat to their, the Jews, lives and livelihood? The Jews would have to be suicidal to do something as crazy as that, wouldn't they? Well, the Jews don't have a death wish, but what they do have is DNA that drives them to destroy whites at all costs, even if they get killed in the process. The Jew Morris Samuels, in his book You Gentiles, wrote, quote, "We Jews, we, the destroyers, will remain the destroyers forever. The wretched fate which scattered us through your midst has thrust this unwelcome role upon us." Unquote. Jews can't fight the biological compulsion they have to kill our people any more than the scorpion could stop itself from stinging the frog in that oft-told analogy. In the past, the Jews were kicked out of just about every country in Europe, sometimes more than once. You would think that that experience would have taught them to curb their behaviour, but it didn't. They kept on working their evil, for which many of them were executed, and kept on being kicked out of one country after another. They just couldn't help themselves. And centuries later, they're still the same. Why? Because race is a biological construct, not a social construct. The Jews' destructive and lemming-like patterns of behaviour have been hard-coded on their DNA. How they act has nothing to do with their culture or their religion, and everything to do with their racial composition. That's why Jews, no matter in which white country they live, will do all they can to bring that country to ruin. And not just in more populous countries like the United States and Britain, but in less populous countries like right here in Australia. Jews, as we shall see, have been major players in the erosion of this country's moral standards and the displacement of its white population, because that's what Jews do and have always done. In Matthew chapter 13, in the parable of the sower and the seed, Yeshua said that there will always be tares, that is, children of the devil placed among the wheat, the children of Israel. And that situation will not change until the end of the age, when the tares, the Jews, go up in flames in a real Holocaust. But for now, owing to our people's failure to obey Yahweh's commandment to exterminate all of them in the Old Testament, check out Joshua chapter 23, verse 13, for example, we have to put up with them in our midst. In this segment, we're going to take a look at some members of Australian Jewry who've had key roles to play in this white country's slow but inexorable demise, and in so doing see that Jews are the same the whole world over. All right, now our first Jew is Izzy Liebler. This is from Wikipedia, and I'm going to include a few of my own little comments throughout this. You'll know them when you hear them. Quote, Izzy Liebler, born 1934, is a Belgian-born Australian-Israeli international Jewish leader with a distinguished record of contributions to the Jewish world and the cause of human rights. Liebler was brought to Australia by his parents as an infant just before the outbreak of World War II. Liebler served as president of the Executive Council of Australian Jewry and chairman of the governing board of the World Jewish Congress. He was one of the pioneering global leaders in the campaign on behalf of Soviet Jewry and played a role in the lead-up to Israeli diplomatic relations between India and China. Liebler moved to Israel in 1999, settling in Jerusalem. Since then, Liebler has emerged as one of the leading global English-language commentators on Israel and Jewish affairs. This is from the September 27, year 2000 edition of the Herald Sun. This article is titled Multiculturalism Not for Israel, and it's written by John Massanauskas, is how I think it pronounces his name. Quote, Melbourne. Jewish leader Izzy Liebler, a staunch defender of Australian multiculturalism, says the policy has no place in Israel. Liebler says, quote, "This is a country which was set up and created as a Jewish country for the Jews," unquote, he told a Jerusalem newspaper. Mr. Liebler has previously said that multiculturalism in Australia was something that, quote, "we are all proud being part and parcel of," unquote. Of course, when Liebler refers to we, he's not referring to white European Australians. The article continues, "The founder of Jet Set Travel, so don't ever book a holiday through Jet Set, folks, moved to Israel 2 years ago as chairman of the World Jewish Congress. He recently published an essay arguing that Zionism, or Jewish nationalism, was under threat in Israel by post-Zionists." This is a quote from Liebler. "A post-Zionist is someone who actually looks positively towards the end of the Jewish people in ethnocentric terms as a national group and no longer sees the Jewish people as one united people," unquote, he told the Jerusalem Post. Mr. Liebler said post-Zionists were pushing a universalist agenda in schools aimed at eliminating Jewish nationalism and creating a multicultural state. But Mr. Liebler, 65, has the opposite view of multiculturalism in Australia, unquote. Well, of course he does. Christ called the Jews hypocrites, so it's only natural that Liebler would want one standard for white Australians and another for so-called Israel. Multiculturalism is Jew-speak for the gradual genocide of the white race. The last thing Jews want is to embrace their own genocide, which is why the imposter Israel nation rejects multiculturalism and why that nation has been booting black immigrants outside its borders. Funny about that, because Jews are often telling us that they are merely adherents of a religion, Judaism, and not a race of people. Well, if that's true, why don't they let blacks stay in their country, some of whom practice Judaism? After all, according to Jews, all one has to do to be a Jew is to adopt Judaism as one's religion. Jew number two is Peter Singer. Now, Peter Singer is a name that will be familiar to a lot of white nationalists. This is from Wikipedia. Peter Albert David Singer, AC, born 6th of July 1946, is an Australian moral philosopher. Well, moral is certainly open to debate. He is currently the Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University and a Laureate Professor at the Centre for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics at the University of Melbourne. So Singer, a godless satanic Jew, is telling white people what is moral and ethical. Give me a break. He specialises in applied ethics and approaches ethical issues from a secular, in other words, he keeps Yahweh and his law out of the equation, preference utilitarian perspective, whatever the hell that is. He is known in particular for his book Animal Liberation, a canonical text in animal rights liberation theory. On two occasions, Singer served as chair of the philosophy department at Monash University, where he founded its Centre for Human Bioethics. In 1996, he stood unsuccessfully as a Greens candidate for the Australian Senate. In 2004, he was recognised as the Australian Humanist of the Year by the Council of Australian Humanist Societies. By the way, humanism is Satanism, for it makes man his own god. And in June 2012, was named a Companion of the Order of Australia for his services to philosophy and bioethics. Give me a break again. He serves on the Advisory Board of Incentives for Global Health, the NGO formed to develop the Health Impact Fund proposal. He was voted one of Australia's 10 most influential public intellectuals in 2006. And Singer currently serves on the Advisory Board of Academic Stand Against Poverty. So what all of the preceding amounts to is that Singer is a Marxist Jew through and through. In an article he wrote titled, "Should This Be the Last Generation?" which should really read, "Should This Be the Last Generation for Whites?" Singer writes, quote, "Most thoughtful people are extremely concerned about climate change. Some stop eating meat or flying abroad on vacation in order to reduce their carbon footprint. But the people who will be most severely harmed by climate change have not yet been conceived. If there were to be no future generations, there would be much less for us to feel guilty about. So why don't we make ourselves the last generation on Earth? If we could all agree to have ourselves sterilized, then no sacrifices would be required. We could party our way into extinction!" Exclamation mark. Unquote. The death of the white race is the Jews' end game, and much of what we see in white society today, legalized abortion, race mixing, feminism, civil rights, the green agenda, animal rights, and so on, are all movements developed and promoted by Jews like Singer to first weaken and then destroy the white race by attacking it from as many different fronts as possible. Singer claims to believe that animals are equal to human beings and ought to have the same rights. But that's just a smokescreen for what he really advocates, and that is for humans, whites in particular, to be regarded as nothing more than animals, which is a view straight out of the Talmud. According to the Talmud, non-Jews aren't human, they're cattle. If humans are only on a spiritual and moral par with animals, as Singer would have us believe, then they are as expendable as and can be treated like animals. The next Jew is Robert Mann. This is from Wikipedia. Robert Mann, born 31st of October 1947, is a professor of politics at La Trobe University, Melbourne, Australia. La Trobe University, by the way, is Australia's premier leftist seat of learning. It's more Marxist than a barrel full of Bolshevik Jews. The article continues, born in Melbourne, Mann's earliest political consciousness was formed by the fact that his parents were Jewish refugees from Europe and his grandparents were victims of the Holocaust. Aren't they all? He was educated at the University of Melbourne and the University of Oxford during the 1960s and 1970s. His university teaching focuses on 20th century European politics, including the Holocaust, communism, and Australian politics. And he has undertaken research in areas such as censorship, anti-Semitism, asylum seekers, and mandatory detention, Australia's involvement in the Iraq War, the Stolen Generations, and the history wars of the 1990s. By history wars, they mean that Mann was doing his utmost to disparage historical revisionism as promulgated by people like David Irving. So here we have a Jew with his finger in just about every anti-white pie you could name. He teaches and or has conducted research on the Holocaust, communism. Now there's a good fit for a Jew, since Jews created world communism, which has killed more whites than the Holocaust ever killed Jews, which of course it didn't. Anti-Semitism, what a shock. Asylum seekers and mandatory detention. No doubt Mann's all for not putting the non-white boat people who arrive uninvited and unwanted on our shores in detention centres. They need to be free to roam our streets, don't you know, raping women and stealing from men. In some cases, raping men and stealing from women. And Mann has conducted research on the Stolen Generations. For overseas listeners to this show, the Stolen Generations is the name given by Marxists in this country to all the Aboriginal children who were, quote, stolen, unquote, from their parents by church and government authorities between 1909 and 1969 in Australia in a very misguided attempt to save them from poor living conditions and to teach them the white man's ways. Most Aborigines are still living in poverty because, being subhumans, they're incapable of creating a civilization or even a shanty town, for that matter. Mann would be well aware of this politically incorrect reality, but because he is a Jew who is compelled to do everything he can to destroy whites, he supports Aboriginal rights because it forces whites to kowtow to them and to balk at expressing any racial unity, lest it invokes memories of whites' mistreatment of Aborigines. If we whites are too scared to think and act for the benefit and preservation of our race, then we are scarcely going to lift a finger to kick the alien parasite called the Jew out of our countries. I was going to include Jerzy Zabriskie in this short list of influential Australian Jews. Zabriskie is known as both the architect and father of Australian multiculturalism. However, there's a bit of a question mark as to whether he was a Jew or not. I used to believe he was, only because other white nationalists said he was. But when I did some research of my own, I couldn't find any info from any reliable source that he was a Jew. He croaked in 2009, and every Australian newspaper obituary for him described him as a Polish Catholic intellectual. No mention was made of his being a Jew, and no Australian Jewish periodical or organisation claimed him as one of their own. So, was he a Jew or wasn't he? I strongly suspect he was, but until I can see some definitive proof, the question mark must remain. If anyone has that proof, please contact me at obadiah18@gmail.com.
Such a tall and gentle man, such a strong and slender hand, reached out. Test me with his loving heart. Jesus,
this segment was originally going to be part three in the CI 101 series I've been doing, but I've deferred that until the next episode of the show. Instead, today I'm going to discuss one of the great controversies in Christian identity, which pertains to the very nature of Jesus Christ, Yahshua, himself. Was he God in a flesh body, or was he the Son of God, an aspect of God with God-like powers, but not God? Some Christian identists, probably the majority, believe he is God, but some believe he isn't. As is to be expected, both sides of the theological divide maintain that their belief is correct and regard those who have the opposite belief to be heretics working to destroy CI from within. The infighting in white nationalism is playground stuff compared to all the infighting that goes on in Christian identity, I'm sorry to say. The problem with both views is that they're absolute. Each refuses to take the other into consideration. Worse yet, on the surface, they cancel each other out, for no matter how many scriptures you produce that state that Christ was God in a flesh body, and there are more than a few of them, you can also produce just as many that state he was the Son of God, and in so many words, just a facet of God. For example, Isaiah chapter 9 verse 6 says, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. And the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father." Whereas Matthew chapter 17 verse 5 says, "While he, Jesus, yet spake, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them. And behold, a voice out of the cloud which said, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him." In John chapter 20 verses 27 to 28 we read, "Then saith he, Jesus, to Thomas, Reach hither thy finger, and behold my hands, and reach hither thy hand, and thrust it into my side, and be not faithless, but believing. And Thomas answered and said unto him, My Lord and my God." Whereas in John chapter 20, verse 31, we read, "But these are written that ye might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing ye might have life through his name." So on the one hand, we are told very plainly that Christ is God, but on the other hand, we are told no less plainly that he is the Son of God. God himself declares that Christ is his Son. So which is correct? Or do we have an insurmountable Bible contradiction here? The answer is found in Numbers chapter 23, verse 19, which reads, "God is not a man that he should lie, neither the Son of Man that he should repent. Hath he said, and shall he not do it? Or hath he spoken, and shall he not make it good?" Now, the only part of the verse we're interested in today is the first clause. God is not a man. God is not a man. Some translations read, "God is not human," which is even more explicit. John chapter 4, verse 24 tells us that God is a spirit. Numbers 23, verse 19 also says that God is not the Son of Man, yet Christ was called the Son of Man. So what does all this mean? It means that both sides of the debate are correct. Jesus was God, but he was also the Son of God simultaneously, and at the same time too. But how can this be, I hear you ask? How can he be God and God's Son? That's impossible. Well, it's impossible for us, yes, but not impossible for God. Luke 1, verse 37 reads, "For nothing shall be impossible for God." Matthew chapter 19, verse 26 reads, "But Jesus beheld them and said unto them, With men this is impossible, but with God all things are possible." The reason for the controversy stems from the fact that often we try to shoehorn Yahweh into our own very limited human understanding, and he just won't fit. The notion that Yahweh is both Father and Son, and that the two of them could be one, is too outlandish for us to wrap our puny little minds around. The irony is we accept without question other supposedly impossible abilities Yahweh has. None of us has any problem with the fact that he's omnipresent, that he can be everywhere at the same time. All of us have prayed to Yahweh, and the chances are pretty darn good that when we prayed, other white people were praying to him too. Yet Yahweh would have heard all of those prayers, and while he was listening to them, he was also seeing to it that the universe, with all its stars, planets, and galaxies, functioned perfectly. How did and does he do it? Because God is not a man, and nothing is impossible for him. I don't know of anyone in Christian identity who doesn't accept that Yahweh can multitask in such a miraculous fashion. We also accept that Yahweh has always existed, that he had no beginning. No one in CI would dispute that. Yet there isn't a single person in CI who could explain it satisfactorily because it's light years beyond our present understanding. So we do what Yahshua tells us to do in these situations. We accept it on faith as little children. Because no matter how much we know about the Bible and Bible history, no matter how fluent we are in Greek, Aramaic, and Hebrew, sooner or later our understanding is going to hit a brick wall, and when it does, we can either throw our hands up and say, this is too hard to believe, so I'm going to reject it, or we can just do what we're supposed to do. Believe it. Believe it because God is not a man, and nothing is impossible for him. God isn't subject to the laws of physics and isn't bound by time and space, so there would be something seriously wrong if he couldn't and didn't do things once in a while that made all logic and reason stagger about as if they'd just stepped out of a centrifuge. Now, to atheists, accepting anything like that on faith is nothing short of insanity. However, every second of every day, Yahweh proves to us that he can be trusted and that he has the whole world in his hand, to quote that ode to universalism we used to sing in Sunday school. We breathe and our hearts beat without our needing to give any thought to it. The sun rises in the east of a morning and sets in the west of an evening as the earth continues to revolve around that enormous star. And the earth hasn't been turned into cosmic dust by a giant rogue meteor slamming into it. We're still here despite ourselves and still living in a universe 99.99% of which is still a vast mystery to us. Not that the universe cares, it goes about its business regardless of the fact that we have no real comprehension of it. So in light of all that, Yahweh's being both Father and Son shouldn't be that much of a stretch for our faith. We don't have to understand it, but we do have to accept it.
Oh, look, I hope I don't cop a rash or something. I remember my dad telling me about his mate during the war. Had a naughty with a Dago tart and the poor bastard's nose dropped off.
This lovely mademoiselle is no ordinary tart. She comes from one of the top families. Convent educated.
She's RC.
RC, AC, DC, the lot.
Adam Goods, the part Aborigine, part white Aussie rules player, has been in the news quite a lot this year. Last year, he made news by singling out a young female footy fan who called him an ape during a football match. That's not an inaccurate term if you've ever seen a photo of Goods. The young lady, who was 13 and white, was then escorted out of the crowd by a couple of security men and questioned in a room without the presence of one of her parents or a guardian, which is illegal, for a couple of hours, all because she called a subhuman an ape. That incident was major news for a week, and the media, not unsurprisingly, made a hero out of the racially mixed Goods, who was lauded for his composure and for forgiving the evil, wicked young white lady. That forgiveness, I must add, was contingent upon her being re-educated about how great Aborigines are. Last January, Goods was made Australian of the Year, an annual award handed out to individuals the politically left deems especially worthy. Since then, Goods has done nothing but gripe about how horribly racist and backward Australia and Australians are. And by Australians, of course, he means white Australians only. If Goods hates white Australians and our racist way of life so much, then he ought to quit his job as an AFL player, which pays him hundreds of thousands of dollars a year because Aussie Rules was invented and is administrated by whites. We won't wait with bated breath for that to happen, though. Goods isn't about to let his anti-white activism get in the way of his AFL cash cow. Also, Goods is keeping company with a very attractive blonde-haired, blue-eyed white woman. If whites are so evil, why isn't he dating an Aboriginal woman? If you've ever seen an Aboriginal woman, you know the answer to that question. So Goods is a staggering hypocrite who is just as much a racist as the people he condemns. You know, when white Europeans first rocked up here in the Great Southland, the Aborigines hadn't managed to build so much as a dam. And I'm not talking about something as massive and as complex as a hydroelectric dam, but a simple hole in the ground used to collect and store water. But yet there I was the other night watching TV when an ad came on featuring Goods who proceeded to gush about the proud history of Aborigines in this country. What proud history? Aborigines haven't contributed anything of worth at all to this country, unless you count drunkenness, random acts of violence and public disorder as positive contributions. They've made no major contribution to the arts or the sciences. All they've managed to accomplish is to squander the billions of taxpayer dollars that have funded various Aboriginal welfare programs over the years. Despite the vast amounts of money lavished on Aborigines, alcoholism, crimes such as rape and child abuse and poverty are still disproportionately high in their communities. No amount of money will ever fix these things, for their problems don't stem from their social milieu or from wicked whitey discriminating against them, but from their DNA. Aboriginal activists, like Goods, are almost always mamses, mongrels in other words. You can change almost always to always when it comes to the more aggressive and vociferous Aboriginal activists, since none of them is a full-blooded Aborigine. The question then is, why do all of these part-white Aborigines side with the part of themselves that isn't white? Why are they always Aboriginal activists and never white activists? For they're just as much white as they are Aborigine. In many cases, they have only a small amount of Aboriginal DNA in them and are predominantly white. Some of them look so white you couldn't tell they were part Aborigine unless somebody told you. This intriguing phenomenon isn't restricted to Aborigines because we see it all around the world, as a matter of fact. In the USA, for instance, the most vocal black activists aren't pure-blooded blacks, but blacks with a degree of white DNA. Yet, like the racially mixed Aboriginal activists here in Australia, they see themselves as non-white rather than white. Of course, being non-white, they can never be white, but still the question must be asked, why do they ignore and resent that part of themselves that is white? It's extremely rare even to hear them acknowledge the white contribution to their DNA. Galatians chapter 5, verse 9 reads, "A little leaven leaveneth the whole lump." So there we have our answer. A little leaven leavens the whole lump, or to put it another way, a little non-white DNA ruins all of the white DNA. There is no such thing in the Bible as 99% pure. That's a worldly concept, not a godly one. To be pure in Yahweh's eyes, we must be 100% pure. Anything less than that is impure. Even the tiniest drop of non-white blood makes somebody a bastard, a mongrel, and unacceptable to Yahweh. Anybody who would tell you otherwise is a wolf out to destroy the flock, and CI has plenty of wolves. We're always being told by our enemies how wonderful, beautiful and natural even it is for the races to mix, and that a mixed society, but only if the host race is white, is a great society. Yet we see in these racially mixed individuals no unity, no togetherness, no love and affection for the white aspect of their biology, only the non-white aspect. And this happens with such frequency and is so pronounced that it cannot be dismissed as coincidence or as just one of those things. It is an actual pattern, and the pattern is attributable to genetics far more than it is cultural influences. The point is that even when two races share the same body, even when they share the same heart, liver, lungs and brain, even when they have every possible thing going in their favour, they still cannot get along. One half of their racial makeup will dominate the other half, and the dominant half will almost always be the non-white half. So if whites and non-whites can't coexist in the same body, how on earth can they coexist in the same community, in the same land? Non-whites, all non-whites, are a deadly poison to our biomass. Allowed to live long enough in our lands, they will ultimately destroy us, and if present in our DNA, will render us null and void in the sight of God and make it impossible for His Spirit to dwell inside of us. This is why no matter how many concessions we make for non-whites, no matter how much we do for them, it will never be enough, and they will still seek to kill us. And why we must never befriend them or make any allegiances with them, and that includes the Palestinians, who so many foolish individuals in the white nationalist community are enamored with because of the persecution they've suffered at the hand of the Jew. Non-whites, even the happy, smiling, kindly ones, are a biological nuclear weapon that, given half the chance, will wipe our people off the map. There are some people in Christian Identity who believe that non-whites are the children of fallen angels. Whether they are or they aren't, the harm they can do to the white race is so devastating that it might as well have been instigated and directed by Satan himself. Hell is non-whites.
Women in the courtyard, children on their knees. Everybody knows them, no one is looking for me. Robbers on the highway, beggars in the street. Everyone is lonely, no one is trying to be. Make way for the kings of the world. Make way for the king. Yes, they still are. It's only a game. We'll come back.
Most of you would be familiar with the story of The Prince and the Pauper. The Prince and the Pauper was a book written by Mark Twain. It's about two boys, Tom Canty and Prince Edward VI, who by a quirk of fate could pass as identical twins. One day, their paths cross, and as both of them aren't happy with their lot in life, Tom hates his austere pauper existence, and Prince Edward hates the trappings and political skullduggery that comes with being a member of royalty, they decide to trade places. Tom becomes Prince Edward for a while, and Edward becomes Tom the Pauper. Edward suffers greatly as a pauper and sees firsthand how cruelly the common man is treated both in his day-to-day existence and through the country's courts. Edward and Tom eventually resume their true identities. Edward is crowned king and, because of his experience living as a pauper, has vowed to be a merciful ruler. He makes Tom an earl and declares him a king's ward, which grants him special status for the rest of his days. Although Revelation chapter 1 verse 6 tells us that Yahweh has made us kings and priests, none of us lives like one at the moment. Us Christian identists aren't exactly rolling in money, and when it comes to fame and prestige, even those of us who have something of a following don't have anywhere near the number of fans as somebody like Joel Osteen does. In my case, I could count fans of this show on the fingers of one hand, if I had that many. Followers, not fingers. The reason our earthly lives don't match our heavenly status is that Yahweh has placed each of us, who has been called and chosen by him, in our own prince and pauper scenario. The difference between our version of the story and the original is that the Jews have taken King Edward's place. They receive all the power and the glory and the riches while we're forced to live like commoners, earning barely enough to get by and suffering persecution from the government, which is working assiduously to outlaw us evil white Christian racists. But our present circumstances don't determine who and what we are. Yahweh's word does. We, like Prince Edward in Twain's classic story, don't lose our royal status just because the world doesn't regard us as kings and priests. Yahshua was still the Son of God and God himself, despite the fact that he lived a lowly existence for 33 years. His circumstances had no bearing on who he was. Yahweh wants us to be a little lower than the angels for the short length of time we get to spend in our flesh body, so that when we help him administrate his kingdom in the next age as immortal beings in immortal bodies, our judgments will be tempered by mercy born of our extensive experience as fallible, imperfect human beings. A child that's in line to inherit his father's business doesn't learn the ropes by starting out in the executive suite. His father will put him to work in the mail room or the storeroom initially, so he gets to know the business from the ground up. So when he's put in charge of that business, he knows its inner workings and how every department affects the business as a whole. Now, we're not going to take over the business as such. Yahweh will always be the CEO, but we'll still get to sit in the boardroom, so to speak. The fact is, we're still learning the ropes, and every new test and trial that comes our way will be harder than the previous test and trial. Just as every new responsibility we take on as we move our way up the corporate ladder will be greater than the last. As our people continue to break Yahweh's laws with no thought for tomorrow, and as the aliens in our lands gain more political, economic and social clout, our circumstances will worsen, but our status as kings and priests will remain the same, as will Yahweh's promises to protect us and see us through to glory. When the disciples were in fear for their lives as their boat was tossed about on the Sea of Galilee during a fierce tempest, Christ calmly stood up and told them not to worry about what was happening around them, but to have faith in God. He let the tempest rage for a while, but then he stopped it. Likewise, he will let the earth and its inhabitants bluster for a while as if the end of creation is nigh, but then he will restore peace and order. The commandment he gave the disciples to have faith is the same commandment he gives us today. The severity of the storm blowing us this way and that is no excuse for us not to have faith, for he is greater than the storm. We spend so much time bemoaning what the Jews are doing to our people and attacking each other for not seeing eye to eye on certain points of scripture that we end up having more faith in the Jews to work evil and in one another to corrupt CI theology than we do in our Heavenly Father. The Amplified version of Colossians chapter 3 verse 2 reads, "And set your minds and keep them set on what is above, the higher things, not on the things that are on the earth." To prepare ourselves for the trying times ahead and for the trying times that are here already, we should meditate on scriptures that tell us who we are in Christ and the great rewards that await those of us who stay faithful, i.e. full of faith, to the very end. The psalmist tells us to forget not all of his benefits. We need to keep reminding ourselves daily of what a privileged people we are, of all the blessings that come with being a king and a priest, with being a son or a daughter of the living God, because the world and the slanderous wolves in our midst are only too eager for us to forget. Time, methinks, for an Oz rock classic. Back in the early 70s, there was an off-Broadway musical called Godspell, which was a universalist take on the gospel according to Matthew. Universalism is the false belief that Christ died on the cross so that anyone of any race can be saved. But what can you expect from a musical written by a pair of Jews and whose very title suggests a fusion of Christianity and witchcraft? Godspell produced one minor hit song called Day by Day, which in its original form wasn't much to sing about. However, in 1971, an Australian recording artist called Colleen Hewitt did a cover version of the song, and with the help of her powerful vocals and some outstanding production work, turned it into an absolute classic. Despite the fact that it was composed by Juden, it does have this very memorable verse. Day by day, O dear Lord, three things I pray. To see thee more clearly, love thee more dearly, follow thee more nearly. Now there's a prayer worth praying. You'll hear a chorus of choir boys toward the end of the song. One of the choir boys is Ross Stevenson, who now co-hosts the top-rating breakfast radio show on Melbourne's 3AW. So here is Colleen Hewitt with Day by Day. By the way, when I said this edition of the show was released in late August of 2014, what I really meant that it was released in early September of 2014. Sorry about the confusion.